You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
Welcome back to The Curious Clinicians, a medical podcast that asks why. I'm Hannah Abrams, and as always, I'm joined by Avi Cooper and Tony Brew. How are you guys doing?
Not too bad. I'm super excited for tonight's topic.
Yeah, doing great. Let's do this.
Awesome. So today we are talking about dyspnea as a symptom of acute myocardial infarction or ischemia. Put it another way, we're talking about why dyspnea is considered an anginal equivalent. So Tony, this is one of the first tutorials that you posted. What got you interested?
So a few things. First, dyspnea is obviously very common. Many of our patients present with a chief complaint of dyspnea, but we also all experience it as individuals, either by, through exercise or if we have conditions like asthma when we're acutely sick. So I think we all have a personal sense of what dyspnea is like, and a lot of our patients experience dyspnea. And that connection of dyspnea with coronary artery disease, I think, is one that medical students learn very early on. I think you're doing a review of systems and you meet a patient who says they have chest pain. It's almost immediately in your mind to say, okay, any shortness of breath, any sweating? And so that connection, I think, is one that we learn early. And it's one that the clinicians of centuries ago had noted. So Heberden and Osler in the 1700s and the early 1900s made this connection between coronary artery disease and a presentation of dyspnea. But it wasn't really until the middle of the 20th century that it came a little bit clear that it was truly an anginal equivalent. So one interesting study I came across was published in 1968. I found the results kind of provocative, and I think they ring at least somewhat true to patients I see now. So they included 184 patients who had coronary artery disease, and they didn't have heart failure or cardiomegaly because they didn't want the symptom of dyspnea in association with heart failure to kind of interfere with their interpretation of the results. And these 184 patients all underwent stress testing. And when the patients noted were noted to have ischemia on the EKG during stress testing, they were asked about symptoms. And 27% had dyspnea as their only symptom. 24% had dyspnea followed by chest pain. 17% just had chest pain, and another 11% had no symptoms at all. So the authors kind of took this as an indication that we really should expand our questioning of patients who we might think have CAD to not just the chest pain angina, but also to dyspnea, this idea of, again, of an anginal quote-unquote equivalent. But to get to like your original question, Hannah, you know, when I looked into this topic for the first time a couple of years ago, it was because I didn't realize or didn't have an understanding of why CAD without heart failure would lead to shortness of breath. And so I wanted to look into it and see if I could find an explanation. And fortunately, there's something there.
Hmm. So, Tony, is this a, you know, obviously we're talking about coronary artery disease. We're assuming that there is a problem with the heart and angina, but is this primarily a heart problem, a lung problem, some other part of the body that's causing these patients to be dyspneic? As a pulmonologist, I'm partial to it being a lung problem, just a priori. But what did you find?
So obviously it's going to probably overlap, even if it begins with the heart. Some of the studies that kind of show that it begins with the heart were from, again, the mid-1900s. And it was sort of around the time that we began floating catheters into LVs and LAs and RVs and began measuring pressures that we were able to sort of see some of these connections. And so some of the earliest observations were that when you had someone who was in the middle of coronary ischemia having angina, there was a rise in their left ventricular end-diastolic pressure, their LVEDP. So I'll give you an example of one of these studies. And it was also actually in 1968, like the first one I mentioned. And this was a group that published out of Mayo. And they included 19 patients with CAD and 5 patients as controls who didn't have known CAD. And they again exercised them. But this time, what they did is they had a catheter in the LV and they measured their pressures at rest and then with exercise. And the patients with CAD had higher resting LV EDPs, about 19 millimeters of mercury versus 16. But they also increased their LV EDP more with exercise. They went from 19 to 30 versus 16 to 20 for the patients who didn't have known CAD. And interestingly, this group also found that if you gave nitro as a pretreatment, it kind of blunted this increase in LV EDP. So again, the upshot, and this is not the only study, there are others, when patients with CAD exercise, there's an increase in their left ventricular end diastolic pressure. And so the question becomes, like, why, of course, does this lead to dyspnea? And actually also, even before that, like, why is that happening?
Yeah, so I've now been an ICU intern for about a week.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Board certified.
You look very well rested.
Thank you. Today is my day off, so I had to learn something. So we've talked a little bit about an elevated wedge pressure, which is our surrogate for left ventricular end diastolic pressure, right, but is a pulmonary capillary wedge pressure, how that can indicate in someone with heart failure that we might have room to go in diuresis. So right, this is sort of what they did. They kind of looked at the LV EDPs for all these patients with CAD after they exercised. So, I mean, is volume a part of this? How does that connect to the dyspnea?
Right. I think it's a really great question. And so one thing to remember is that there's at least two things, and there actually are probably more, but there are two things that I usually think about as being determinants of your left ventricular end diastolic pressure. And so one is the volume, and that's what you're referring to, Hannah, right? So if you have a lot of extra volume in a patient who has heart failure, for example, their LV EDP is going to be increased. And the other thing that can increase LV EDP is decreased LV compliance. All right, so let me state that again. So if you have more volume in the LV, without a change in compliance, the pressure is going to go up. Or if you have the same amount of volume, but the compliance has gone down, the pressure is also going to go up. So it could be either one. And so there was some debate in the 60s and 70s when they were first measuring the pressures in the LV during ischemia. They're like, we don't know which one it is. And really in the 1970s, it became clear that it was a decreased compliance. And this came from studies where they would do pacing-induced ischemia. So they would put an LA pacer in and they would just make the heart rate go up. And they would measure both the end-diastolic pressure but also the end-diastolic volume. And what they would find in these patients with angina is that the pressure went up but the volume did not increase. And so it wasn't the volume, but they did find a decrease in compliance. So with ischemia, the LV was stiffer, due to decreased compliance, and that would increase the end-diastolic pressure. And so there's a few different theories for like why that might occur. And I think right now, as best I understand, the kind of like leading theory is this idea of the rigor bond.
Rigor bond, like rigor mortis?
I think so. I think it's basically the same idea.
Sounds the same.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's the same kind of phenomena with rigor mortis where, after someone has died and there's not enough ATP, the muscles don't relax, and so there's increased stiffness. And so I think it's the same thing in the LV because, we have to remember that relaxation of muscle, whether it's skeletal muscle or cardiac muscle, is energy dependent. And so more specifically, it's dependent on ATP. The ATP is used to pump calcium back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and it's used to dissociate actin and myosin cross-bridging. So you need ATP to relax a muscle. And if you've got someone with CAD and they're exercising, the vessels that are feeding the myocardium are going to deliver less oxygen, less ATP is going to be created. And when the ATP levels drop, this ATP-dependent relaxation is going to be blunted. That's going to lead to decreased compliance. The decreased compliance is going to lead to increased LV EDP. So it's like you can sort of see we're marching our way backwards in this flow diagram that eventually is going to lead to dyspnea.
Eventually.
Eventually.
Okay. Well, I would say I have to work hard to relax too. I mean, it.
I know diastole is hard.
Yes, it is. That's right. That's your like relax. Your day right now, Hannah. Like this is your diastolic day at your one day off. It's not easy to relax.
It's all about the filling time. Anyway, all right. Let's take a second and go through everything that we've talked about so far before we get to how this actually gets to dyspnea. So Heberden and Osler first noted this connection. Been waiting on that for like 10 minutes. But really what we did is figured out, we essentially put people on treadmills first in 1968 and then in this Mayo Clinic study from slightly later, and figured out, one, that when people with CAD were experiencing ischemia, they were feeling dyspneic. Mm-hmm. And two, that their left ventricular and diastolic pressures were what was going up, specifically right. with exercise.
Yes.
And then kind of thinking through what causes an increase in left ventricular and diastolic pressure. So one could either be volume or the second could be compliance. And we know from animal studies, wait, sorry, did we do this with animal studies or did they actually pace humans?
These are human beings.
Oh, geez. Okay. So we know.
Well, there probably were animals at some point. But this was a human. This one from 1972 with atrial pacing, that was humans. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Anyway, so we know from these studies, though, that it's the compliance aspect, right? So left ventricular and diastolic pressure is either volume or compliance. And in this case, we know that it's compliance, and maybe it has something to do with diastole being an energetic process. Okay. So I'm short of breath through all of that. Is the patient short of breath?
No, not yet. They may have an increased LVEDP, but that in and of itself, unless there's something I haven't come across, and I'm not sure, Avi or Hannah, if you've come across anything, I don't think that in and of itself leads to the dyspnea. But that pressure is going to be transmitted to the left atrium, assuming the patient doesn't have, you know, severe mitral stenosis. And then it's going to be transmitted to the pulmonary vasculature. And then once it's in the pulmonary vasculature, this last step for how it leads to the dyspnea, I'll be honest, I don't know that I read something that was definitive that said it's absolutely X. But I did come across a few leading theories, and I'll share two with you. And I'm interested in if you guys have any insights or thoughts. So the two things that I came across most commonly were that the increased pressure in the pulmonary vasculature led to decreased lung compliance, and that led to dyspnea. And the other was that the increased pulmonary vascular pressures led to interstitial edema and then activation of C fibers. And C fibers are known to be dyspneogenic. So one of the studies I mentioned earlier, the one with the atrial pacing, that found the decreased LV compliance. They also found decreased lung compliance in these patients who had LVEDPs that were up. And so their hypothesis was that the interstitial edema was leading to worsening lung mechanics, and it was that was leading to dyspnea. So Avi, you're our resident pulmonologist. Does that seem like a reasonable hypothesis to you?
Yeah, it does. I mean, certainly congested lungs are stiffer lungs. That's well known. And I think there could be an airway component and resistance as well, in the sense, you know, we've probably all heard the cardiac wheeze, so-called, when people are in acute pulmonary edema and they sound very wheezy. That congested interstitium that you get can actually narrow the bronchioles and cause an increased airways resistance, and then also contribute to dyspnea too.
Yeah, and I think one thing to remember is that you don't have to have massive pulmonary edema such that you would see it on chest x-ray, but you might have just enough interstitial edema that it leads to the decreased lung compliance. So anyway, the other hypothesis, again, relates to activation of the C fibers. Decades ago, they were known as juxtacapillary or J receptors, and these are... they're activated when the pulmonary vascular congestion is increased. And again, they can lead to the sensation of dyspnea via simulation of the vagus nerve. And there are a number of case reports of patients who undergo vagotomy or vagotomy, and that actually alleviates the sensation of dyspnea. And so one case report that we'll put in the show notes was this 43-year-old patient who had unilateral pulmonary venous obstruction, so had very elevated pulmonary pressures on one side, and she had dyspnea that was just unrelenting, and they couldn't really find an explanation. So they decided to just cut the vagus nerve, and that stopped her dyspnea, and she was essentially cured. I think it's – yeah, go ahead, Avi.
Well, I think that fits really well, too. If you think about the histology of the J receptors or the C fibers, whatever you want to call them, the juxtacapillary name is really appropriate. They're right next to the blood vessels. And so, you know, congested pulmonary vasculature is going to irritate and trigger those J receptors.
Yeah, they terminate right in the interstitium, right by those capillaries. So if you have a little bit of interstitial edema, like it doesn't need to be a lot, just enough to activate these receptors. Again, you don't have to see it on chest x-ray. You don't have to see it on CT. You just have to have enough for these things to be activated. But I'll tell you, it's I don't know that it's totally a done deal, settled deal, that this is like the final part of the pathway to dyspnea. It's just one that you'll often see.
Yeah, it's so interesting. A primary care patient of mine had very, very severe aortic stenosis and basically was living with these like really chronically elevated pressures. Like his wedge pressure was 22. But he didn't actually, I mean, he didn't have that much dyspnea. And something that we talked about was sort of what is the extent of collateral circulation, because dyspnea wasn't his predominant symptom. Mm-hmm. And so what is kind of the extent to which these chronically elevated pressures have led to collateral pulmonary circulation building up? And I'm sort of curious if it's almost the opposite of that unilateral pulmonary venous obstruction in that patient, right, where over time there's compensation.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I don't know about collateralization, but I know that, you know, the pulmonary vasculature is very, it's a high compliance circuit. And so over time it can, for any given pressure, like left ventricular and diastolic pressure, you'll have less pulmonary congestion if it's more chronic. So that's why sometimes people with really high wedge pressures don't have a lot of pulmonary edema, even though you'd expect them to have that.
But they might have—
if it's chronic and they've accommodated.
But they still might have dyspnea if there's interstitial edema.
Totally.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense.
So— how can how could I use all of this information that we've talked about if I saw that patient or if I saw another patient with dyspnea as a anginal equivalent?
Yeah, and so I think one thing is, you know, going back to that original study from 1968 that found dyspnea as a common chief complaint, just, you know, don't ignore it in someone who has risk factors. You think they don't have chest pain, so it's not CAD. It certainly can be, and in fact. There's some data suggesting that because we're talking about the LV in all these discussions, there's some data suggesting that patients who have a presentation of dyspnea as their anginal equivalent are more likely to have LV involvement, LAD involvement, potentially worse disease. And one study, in fact, found that the anterior MIs were more often presented with dyspnea compared to, say, an RV MI, which is less likely to present with dyspnea. And it kind of makes sense, right? If we're talking about LV-EDP, the LV should be the part of the heart that's ischemic. Dyspnea is actually also associated with worst outcomes. And so if we have a patient coming in with dyspnea plus or minus angina, that, you know, I'm not necessarily sure how that's going to acutely change our management, but we should probably have a heightened sense of concern about that patient. And it may be that they're more likely to also have heart failure concurrent with that. These patients, I think, can be sicker than the patients who have just angina as their chief complaint. And then I'll offer one other cool connection that may or may not help you know, you as an intern or me and Avi as attendings.
I sure hope it doesn't.
But so this is about the idea that ticagrelor, one of the antiplatelet agents, is known to be dyspneogenic. So randomized trials comparing it to, say, clopidogrel, the patients have much more dyspnea. And the what's interesting as far as a connection is ticagrelor inhibits clearance of adenosine, and it's actually adenosine that's activating the C fibers. And so there's this sort of interesting connection that maybe ticagrelor is causing the same kind of dyspnea that that this anginal equivalent is. So I don't know. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, that is really interesting. Yeah, and we've focused on left ventricular ischemia on this episode, but you know, right ventricular ischemia and infarcts can also produce dyspnea. Those patients can present dyspneic as well. And I didn't see a lot of literature on the mechanisms for that, but I think a couple of possibilities. One, you know, they can have acute decreases in cardiac output, certainly, and as the RV fails. And another one might be that with increase in RV pressure volume overload, because of an interventricular interdependence, you get impaired filling of the left ventricle as the right ventricle dilates. And that would elevate the left ventricular end diastolic pressure and link to those mechanisms, Tony, that you've been talking about. So I think that's another kind of interesting question that's been, it seems like, less studied than the LV.
It is less studied, and it's to some extent problematic because RV infarcts, as you said, clearly can present with dyspnea. And I don't think it's only because they're in heart failure. I think some of them, it's just the ischemia in and of itself.
Well, Tony, thanks again for a really interesting episode. And can you give us your take-home points?
Sure. So number one, myocardial ischemia leads to decreased LV compliance, and the decreased LV compliance leads to increased LV EDP. So you know, it's going to come back to LV EDP in a lot of these scenarios. That increased LVEDP is transmitted to the left atrium and then to the pulmonary venous system. And then this leads to interstitial congestion, interstitial edema. And that interstitial edema leads to dyspnea. And whether it's from decreased lung compliance from, you know, poor mechanics or activation of the pulmonary C fibers, I think that last piece is the piece that, at least based on the reading that I did, that's less settled. But it's probably one of those two, if not obviously a combination.
Great. Well, that's it for today's episode. Next time on the podcast, we'll be asking, why does umami taste so good? In the meantime, thanks again for joining us. If you have an interesting tutorial or online meta teaching point you think that we should feature on the show, please tag us on Twitter. I'm at Abraham Cooper MD.
And I'm at Tony_Brew.
And I'm at Hannah R. Abrams. You can also follow the podcast on Twitter at CuriousClinPod. You can also join our mailing list at CuriousClinicians.com to stay up to date on episode releases and receive the show notes for each episode in your inbox. You can find information how to get on CME and mock credit for just listening to the episode on the website as well. And as always, the information contained in this episode is for educational and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Until next time, we've been the Curious Clinicians.
Bye.
Bye.
The Curious Clinicians are excited to partner with VCU Health to offer continuing education and ABIM maintenance of certification credits for physicians. Tap the link in the show notes or visit ce.vcuhealth.org/curiousclinicians for more information.